Good morning. I call the Human Services Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. With that, I'll begin with the approval of the minutes from March 11th, 2026. Vice Chair Keelan, did you get a chance to read the minutes?
Yes.
All right. Vice Chair Keelan moves the approval of minutes of March 11th, 2026. Discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are now adopted. With that, members, we have three bills. Two bills will be laid over, and then the other bill will be informational hearing. Representative Frazier, welcome to the Human Services Committee, and I will move that House File 3174 be laid over for possible inclusion. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chair, members. House File 3174 addresses an issue with Minnesota's background study system that affects individuals who are permanently disqualified from working or volunteering in healthcare and social service settings. Minnesota's background study process exists for an important reason: to protect vulnerable populations. That goal must always remain at the center of our work. But at the same time, we should ensure that our system recognizes when individuals have truly demonstrated rehabilitation and are ready to contribute positively back to their communities. Under current law, some individuals receive permanent disqualifications that prevent them from working in healthcare or social services for the rest of their lives. Even if many years have passed and they have shown clear evidence of rehabilitation, there is currently no pathway for them to request individual reconsideration. As a result, they remain permanently locked out of these fields with no opportunity to demonstrate that they have changed. The background for this bill comes from work that the state has already undertaken. In 2022, Minnesota convened a Human Services Background Study Eligibility Task Force to examine how our background study laws are functioning and whether improvements were needed. The task force found that Minnesota's system is stricter than many other states. It also found that individuals can remain disqualified from employment even when they may no longer pose a risk. Perhaps most importantly, the task force identified that permanent disqualifications lack a reconsideration pathway, unlike other disqualifications that last 7, 10, or 15 years, and already allow individuals to seek review after time has passed. Based on those findings, the task force recommended that Minnesota create a pathway for individuals with permanent disqualifications to request reconsideration, similar to the opportunity that already exists for those with time-limited disqualifications. House File 3174 takes a step in that direction. The bill allows permanently disqualified individuals to request a set-aside from the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services under specific circumstances. Importantly, this bill does not create a new or unfamiliar process. DHS already administers a set-aside review process for other types of disqualifications. What this bill does is extend that existing process so that individuals who currently face permanent disqualification may request the same type of individualized review. This approach maintains strong protections for vulnerable Minnesotans while also allowing the state to consider each case on its merits. It ensures that decisions are based on careful review and risk assessment rather than a blanket lifetime barrier with no opportunity for reconsideration. At a time when many healthcare and social service providers are facing workforce shortages, this change also helps Minnesota employers access qualified workers who have demonstrated rehabilitation and a commitment to service. More importantly, it allows individuals who have turned their lives around to support their families and give back to their communities. In short, House File 3174 preserves the safeguards that protect vulnerable populations while introducing fairness and common sense into the system. It recognizes that people are capable of change and that our policy should allow for accountability alongside opportunity. I appreciate the committee's consideration of this, and I do have an amendment that I'd like to move before discussion.
Chair Verisha moves the approval of A2 amendment. Any discussion? This is a technical amendment in nature. If you can please.
It is a technical amendment in nature. Initially, we had sought to move the set-asides to the Office of Administrative Hearings. We are striking that to allow them to remain with the Department of Human Services because that process already exists and they're very familiar with it, so we'll leave it there.
Any discussions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is now adopted. to your bill as amended, you have testifiers.
Please, yes, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Megan Forbes, and I'm an attorney at the Institute for Justice. We're a nonprofit public interest law firm that works to protect civil liberties, including the right to earn a living. This bill addresses a serious problem with the state's background study process and brings reform that's long overdue. Under current law, some people face permanent disqualifications that can prevent them from working in jobs indefinitely with no opportunity to appeal for a set-aside. These bans often last for decades, and they apply without any individualized consideration or recognition of rehabilitation over time. They also present serious constitutional concerns. For many, permanent disqualifications become a lifelong barrier to working in meaningful jobs. Permanent disqualifications also prevent people with valuable lived experience, especially those who've gone through recovery themselves, from working in therapeutic and rehabilitative roles where they could help others. And we've seen these being areas where there are shortages. And what we've seen and heard is that employers are being required by the government to turn away capable people who they've hired, often months after the person has worked in the job. This bill simply allows the right to appeal in certain circumstances. These circumstances include that there's been no conviction for the alleged crime within 5 years. So even if you're not convicted with a crime right now, it's possible that you could be permanently disqualified. So the bill addresses that issue. If a conviction was pardoned or expunged, or if 10 years have passed since release or sentence completion. The state already uses this kind of individualized review for other disqualifications, and it protects economic liberty without compromising safety. It's a fair approach. Research consistently shows that meaningful employment is one of the most effective ways to support successful reentry. We thank the committee for considering this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Forbes. We have another testifier, Mr. Paul. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Noor. Good morning. My name is Thomas Powell. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of this bill. At the age of 19, I was convicted of a crime of robbery with a deadly weapon in Maryland. I was given a 20-year sentence as a result, and later released on parole after serving 6.5 years. Following my release, I came to Minnesota to address my substance abuse problem. I entered treatment and successfully completed it. I was first able to secure employment at AT&T. During my employment, I earned 2 leadership awards and successfully completed my parole obligation in 1991. I also worked directly with the treatment program I had entered in varying capacities for about 8 years. During that time, for extra income, I secured an evening part-time position with the Domestic Abuse Project as the educator and process therapist for their court-ordered adult and juvenile males. I worked at the Domestic Abuse Project for over 15 years and subsequently left to work at the Legal Rights Center as a community worker and family group conference facilitator. In my free time, I also facilitated a male second chance early release group and a parenting curriculum in 3 of the correctional facilities here in the state of Minnesota. I share some of this background because permanent disqualifications were not an issue for some of my work. However, in the last 20 years, despite my work and volunteer experience, because of my conviction from more than 50 years ago, I have been struggling to maintain employment. I have been permanently disqualified from working in 4 jobs now involving social services. I was able to work at each position for varying periods of time before the background check disqualification. And my employers have not wanted to let me go, but have been legally required to do so. And then that's it. There's no ability to get this disqualification set aside like other background study disqualifications, because my crime is on the permanent disqualification list. This has been challenging for me, and I know that there are others like me, too, in the same position. I am a single father. I'm still raising two. Losing employment has been devastating financially, not once, but four times. I have no criminal record since the conviction from when I was a teenager, and I am now 75 years young. I support this bill because people should be judged on their merit and have a fair opportunity to work when there is no longer a risk of harm. This bill helps provide that fair chance and will make a difference for people like me, families, and for our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul, for sharing your story and informing us about your journey. So thank you so much for that. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Going once, seeing none, we'll now move to member discussion. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. First question I have is, would this create inconsistent ruling depending on which judge is overseeing it? Because you would have more than one judge that would oversee these cases, if I understand this correctly.
Chair Frazier or Ms. Faulds?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So it would be the same set-aside process that currently happens where the commissioner oversees it. I think there may be legal staff that's involved in the review, but it's the set-aside process that the state's currently using, where the person is looking at set factors that are consistent across each case and determining on an individualized basis if the person poses a risk of harm.
Representative Beck.
So it does sound like, depending on who hears it, there could be a different type of ruling for person A compared to person X. I mean, I understand what you're saying is that there will be a process and there will be some normality with the people reviewing the cases, but at the end of the day, it does go to someone to make that final decision, and that same person would not be in. And that would be a concerning because we have different life experiences and so forth, and I appreciate your life experience that you shared, and so forth. So I appreciate that. My next question is, and this could be, it's not designed to be an insensitive question, but why are we weakening the permanent disqualifications that exist to protect children and vulnerable adults? Why would we, answer that, please. Why would we want to do that?
Ms. Forbes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. In our view, this isn't weakening the permanent disqualifications. They remain. It's a case-by-case determination that would be made after a long period of time has passed. And it would be the determination of whether the person poses a risk of harm based off of what's changed in their circumstances and their rehabilitation. So the state is very much involved still in making sure that that protection is in place for vulnerable people. And if the state determines that the person no longer poses that risk of harm, they would have the ability to set it aside. But that permanent disqualification remains. It's just for that particular job where the set aside would be potentially granted for that person to work.
Representative Brian.
So let's go way to the other spectrum. Someone got a waiver and they harmed someone after they got, who's responsible for that? Is DHS responsible? Is the judge responsible? But someone went through the process. They were deemed they could work with children and vulnerable adults, but we're all humans. They have a setback, and they harm somebody. What happens then?
Ms. Forbes.
Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I think, you know, the responsibility would be on the employer and the person, but you know, just like with any other set aside, I think there's always this potential risk. But the idea is that with the standards that are in law and with all of the evidence that the state's considered, that these types of situations, it's designed to prevent these types of situations. But there is the element, too, where an employer is hiring the person and taking on responsibility as well for that person working in the position.
Representative Ryan.
So what I'm hearing, and thank you for that, so what I'm hearing is the employer would need to know that, make sure, you know, there's that check and balance, you know, which is sometimes easier said than done, because generally the employer is overseeing multiple people. I just would like, you know, I'm quite concerned with the with children and vulnerable adults that they're not taken advantage of in a situation that the employer, because the employer cannot always be there. So we would need to really set up some guidelines, because obviously society has deemed this person a risk. Now, I totally understand that people, you know, there are several individuals like our testifier who has matured out of it. We make mistakes. We all make mistakes when we're younger and so forth, even some of us when we're older, and so forth. So that would be a concern of mine to protect, because that's what the state is here. I'm more apt on the employee, employer taking more ownership. I mean this sincerely, but DHS does not have a good track record in this arena and so forth, because obviously the people closest to them would have the vested interest, as long as that employer is doing it for the right reasons. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Any response to Ms. Forbes on that?
Thank you for, I think everybody shares the concerns, Representative, about protecting vulnerable people and children, and those are very important concerns. And I think this process strikes that balance of trying, it's a balance, right? I also just want to note that this is beyond the conviction that the person has had. So a lot of times what we're seeing is people are out for decades living their lives. Their conviction and their sentence is, passed, and they still have their conviction, obviously, but they've served their sentence. And we're seeing this record following them their entire life with no possibility to work in a lot of jobs.
Yeah, and I agree with you. There's a lot of people who make those changes and corrections in their lives, but there are also individuals that don't get past that, and we have to balance that. That's my concern. I see where you're going and so forth, though we do have bad actors and stuff like that. So thank you for the discussion.
Mr. Chair, if I may just to put a point on that, I think, Rep. Becker, your concerns are very valid, and I appreciate you sharing them. But this creates a process that doesn't exist now. It creates an opportunity for those individuals, like Mr. Powell that just spoke here, which is a perfect example, over 50 years, no issues. But his situation from when he's a 19-year-old is following him, as he's 75 years young now, has been following him this entire time. And now we're going to be able to create a process to allow folks to take a look at that. With that same criteria of looking at the risks, to have an opportunity to look at his individual case to say, you've been rehabilitated, you've done a great job in the last 50 years, you should have the opportunity to access this field to take care of yourself and take care of your young children. I think that's the point we should be looking here foundationally. This is not changing the standards. We're still going to be looking at that risk, but we're creating a pathway for these individuals to have an opportunity that they currently do not have.
So we have four members on the list, and we've got two more bills that we have so many people who came to testify. We'll start with Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. This is going to probably sound weird to folks, but I actually am very supportive of this. And the reason, I know. But the reason is because I've encountered, Representative Jacob and I had an instance last year where a constituent of mine went to childcare at a home childcare center in his district, and the husband of the childcare provider had a crime when he was, what was it, Jacob, like 18, 19? He'd completed his sentence. He had everything. He was now, you know, middle-aged and boring with a wife and kids, and she had to shut down her child care center because of the permanent set-aside. There was no option for them to overturn it, even though it had been 20 years. He was and all of the daycare parents, many of whom lived in my district, were like, they're great. These are amazing people. And it was not something that... It wasn't abuse of a child. It wasn't the things that are still on the permanent list that you have in your bill. Mm-hmm. It was very much like your testifier's story. It was a very similar story. And so, and I was just flabbergasted that I was losing another family child care provider over something that happened over 25 years ago. And it didn't make any sense to me. And so I'm really grateful that you're bringing this bill forward, because we need a process when it makes sense to have a process. And I appreciate that this is a well thought out process and still protects folks by making sure that the most concerning crimes are still on the permanent set aside. But for those that are not those things, there's an option if folks have rehabilitated and can contribute to our community. So thank you.
We'll move to Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am so glad that you came to testify. I sense that I could trust you as much as I trust Representative Jeff Backer. And that's a lot.
I don't know about that. He may be lying.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think the way this can go, so what you've shown us is there is some threshold beyond which the time has passed, you've done wonderful things in the interim, and you are fit to serve in different capacities that maybe right now you're not allowed to serve in. So I think the one encouragement, I know this is considered for being laid over, and make sure we pay really close attention to that list of what specific criminal acts would stay on the preserved list. What number of years do we want to see from the last conviction until no conviction? And then what's the person done in between? Right, those are the key factors that you've already identified. And just in conversation, you could even come out, you know, a little bit conservative and keep a few things on there, see how it goes for a time. Maybe even some guardrails once you would come back in for 1 year, a little extra oversight. So there are ways that this can happen. And again, I'm just thankful that you came along to open our eyes to the potential that does exist here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gunn. I think you're reminding me that we had a bipartisan report on this issue, and this is part of the recommendation that they gave to us, and I can share with you that recommendation that came to us previously. There were a few things that we took care of, but one of the issues that we haven't resolved is this set-aside issue. So I'll send it to you so you can read the details. So recommendations out there. I'll go to Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and Mr. Powell, thank you for sharing your story today. It's very informative and helpful. I think the bill that we have in front of us is a very good bill, and where it's really important is first of all, let's consider is the infraction happened when a person is 19, and it's not unusual because of brain development. People sometimes act out impulsively, and the brain isn't formally formed until age 26. So there are decisions that people make very early on that, you know, after years and giving back to the community and corrections, that they are able to become involved and help offer assistance to other people. And that's what I'm hearing from Mr. Powell. There are people who have made bad decisions when they're very young, have changed their whole life. And what happens is when they're connecting with younger people, I'm thinking of particularly youth at risk, is they are able to very easily connect with somebody like Mr. Powell in ways that they would not be able to connect with somebody else. And people like Mr. Powell then are able to help guide them to make sure that these youngsters can find another path out there and not repeat the mistakes that Mr. Powell had been in. And this is where I feel it's very important to be able to have the opportunity for the set aside there, because these are the kind of experiences that actually, and people who can help actually make our community safer by engaging in these different areas. So I want to say thank you for taking the time to be here today. Thank you for the bill.
Thank you so much, Chair Fisher. Representative Vining.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Frazier. Last year, I attended a behavioral mental health conference in northern St. Louis County on the range, and one of the issues that came up was with peer-to-peer supports and the background study causing a problem for people who had gone through recovery and wanted to participate in peer-to-peer supports, and knowing that that lived experience made them a better peer-to-peer provider. And so I texted and said, hey, this bill is up. Would this help? And they said, yes, yes, please pass the bill. So I am extending a thank you from the folks that I met with up on the range. This would be a positive step towards filling a deep need. If you're not aware, northern St. Louis County has the highest suicide rate in the state, has one of the highest substance use rates. So more we can do to help, the better. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick question for Ms. Forbes. if somebody is not convicted but they were arrested, will the record also be reflecting that this person was arrested and they may be disqualified?
Chair Noor, yes, that's our understanding. And we actually had a client that was in that situation. She was ultimately able to get reconsideration for correctness and get it set aside, but it is a challenging issue for some. And as you know, there's the preponderance of the evidence standard too, so it's a different standard that's used as well in determining whether or not the person should be disqualified than what we see in the criminal justice system, and it's a much lighter standard that's used.
To follow up, if someone is accused of any maltreatment but there was no findings, will that also be included in this circumstance? Somebody reported them to DHS and it stays on their record, whether they were young or adult, will that stay?
Chair Noor, there is an exclusion for any type of crime that's involving children. So it would depend, I think, on the type of maltreatment, that whether it would fall under this process.
If you can let us know what disqualifications that this is not going to involve, you know, permanent disqualifications such as criminal sexual misconduct, crime against involving children, mm-hmm. and I think many other crimes are listed that this will not qualify. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair. This would not apply for murder, criminal sexual misconduct, or crimes involving children. Those are
or any other mistreatment. Thank you so much. I think that there's work that we have to do. We're excluding a workforce that can help. For instance, if an individual wants to work in the back room doing the kitchen work and so many other things, simple tasks that can be done by individuals who have been rehabilitated or people who have not been, accused of all the other things that we have just discussed will be excluded from working in any setting that involves not only adult but also children or whatever the circumstance that may be. So I think we have good work to do, and I think we need to be considering putting a process out. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple questions about, you know, how you determine which crimes are permanently banned. Maybe talk about the other crimes that aren't, and why are we focusing on this sector of opportunity for this group? But talk about that permanent ban, and then talk about the other ones that are not.
Ms. Falk.
Sure. So there is a list in statute of crimes that qualify for the permanent disqualification. So it's statutory, and then there are also different types of temporal disqualifications for other types of crimes too. But it's set by statute, and I think the reasoning with the process here, and as has been said today, but let's see how this goes. But taking out the crimes that are the most violent still and keeping those safeguards in place if a person killed somebody, for example. But there are crimes that are on the list. Just to give an example, aggravated assault is a crime, or aggravated robbery, like in Thomas's situation. So these are crimes that are on the permanent disqualification list that are a bit different from murder, but still having that permanent effect.
Chair, how did you determine which ones? I mean, for instance, felony assault, domestic assault by strangulation, criminal sexual conduct may or may not, depending on, you know, if it's first degree, second degree. There's a lot of, in that statute, there's a lot of crimes that, it's interesting you just picked, the ones you thought were most, egregious. And that's what we are going with here. So that, and then my first question again is, why this sector for that? Why are we going for this sector?
Ms. Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So the reason we picked these guardrails is based off of conversations we've had with legislators. And the original guardrails were put in place by the legislature who did that line drawing. And I totally agree with you. It's difficult to draw these lines. This is this is a really challenging thing, but this line has been drawn where there are these permanent disqualifications for certain crimes, and this bill reflects more than a year's worth of conversations we've had with legislators and bill sponsors. Senator Curran is sponsoring this on the Republican, on the Senate side, you know, and is a Republican, and he was very supportive of this too. But different conversations we've had to try to find that right balance. But it is a very difficult thing to do.
I think, Representative Murphy, to address the question that you have, why this industry, I think, Ms. Fobbs, if someone has got a loved one that they live with and there's a disqualification, that will not even be authorized to work with that individual. Is that correct? If someone, you know, spouse or child, or, that they're able to do that work, will they be authorized to do any, although they live together?
Yes, that's correct, Chair. Yes. Yes, and this, these are set for It's set for jobs where people could potentially be serving vulnerable populations. That's why these lines have been drawn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, even like drive-by shootings, I don't know how we determine which one is more egregious. It all depends on a lot of conditions. Mm-hmm. It seems like a really big group of exemptions moving forward on this, and that would be a concern that I'd have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any closing remarks from the testifiers?
Just
Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the conversation. I do appreciate it. I think it was pretty robust. Good questions, good concerns raised that we can probably take a look at as we move the bill forward. At the end of the day, I think from a society perspective, we believe in accountability. We're a country of rule of laws. We set those. We hold people accountable. But I think we also believe in redemption and having a second chance. And currently what we have now in this process is we don't have the ability for these individuals like Mr. Powell to have a second chance to work in these fields. So we're creating that second chance. We have accountability. We've applied that. Now we're creating a pathway for second chance, which we know helps people's do better and it stabilizes communities. So I appreciate the conversation and hope to get support as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House file 3178, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill on the calendar, 3174, did I move to 8? As amended, is laid over. Representative Hicks, please move your bill and introduce.
Good morning, Sam. Good morning, committee. I would like to move House File 3800 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hicks moves 3800 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee. House File 3800 is an attempt to create some protections for individuals who are currently receiving waivered services as we move into Waiver Reimagined Phase 2. At its core, the bill puts in some guardrails to ensure that people do not lose needed services simply because we are moving into Phase 2 for Waiver Reimagined. Under the current language, it limits reductions for an individual's authorized waiver budget to no more than 10% unless there's a documented need decrease. So I want to be really clear about that. Every year, people who receive waiver services go through a MnChoices assessment. That assessment determines need. It is ideal when people's needs decrease. That's what we're going for, right? We want to see people need less services. This would not change that if there is truly a need decrease. It would just guarantee that a waiver budget amount does not go down simply because we are changing the way we do things. I want to clarify that piece, as that has been a question that I received yesterday. It requires a cost of living adjustment to be built into the Waiver Reimagine Phase 2 methodology, and it creates a very narrow individualized budget exception for certain people who have hospital level of needs and need access to direct self-directed home nursing. Many of you were here for that hearing last year when we heard about how nursing in particular for children is really impacted. So wanting to address that as well. It does not stop Waiver Reimagine from moving forward. And it really does make sure that this very needed modernization that we are doing does not come at the expense of people who are already receiving services. I have a lot of other details that I can share with the committee if we have questions, but we have in your packets a very long list of letters from people who receive services and supporting organizations. I would really encourage everyone to look through this. Take time to read the stories of the people who are receiving services and who are impacted by these things. Listen to their voices through these letters and through their testimony today to help better understand how terrified people are that the change that we are making as legislators may impact their services. With that, Chair, I'd really like to allow my testifiers time to chat.
Jillian Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Noir and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, the Policy Director for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also a disabled adult and a waiver recipient. We're here today to ask for your support for House File 3800. We're asking you to formalize an agreement that Minnesota has long had with people with disabilities, an agreement that we get to live our lives with self-determination in the least restrictive setting, an agreement to uphold the Olmstead Act, and an agreement to not harm people with disabilities with DHS legislation. Since the beginning of discussions about Waiver Reimagine, we have been told that our services and supports won't change, that we can stay in our preferred living settings, that our budgets would be comparable, and that we would be okay. As the project developed and we started seeing evidence in policy and procedure that strongly indicated that the things we were told were probably not true. This launch has been delayed over and over trying to get it right, and in the process, our trust in DHS has been eroded. This bill, House File 3800, is a contract to rebuild that trust. It says that the legislative body will hold DHS accountable to keeping their word to us. It says that it's not okay to promise security and safety and then pull a switcheroo when it's too late to change anything. It says the work that's been done by this community and body for decades will not be done undone overnight, and we will not have to start fighting for redirection all over again. It means that we can stay in our homes, in our jobs, in our communities. I promise you a 10% cut will not be something that comes to us inconsequentially. Hard choices are still going to be made. I'm going to have to choose between therapies that manage my pain and support for activities of daily living. Some people are going to have to make medical equipment last longer, maybe cut back on community engagement activities. But 10% won't destroy our support systems. Any cuts above that would shatter the foundations we have built our lives on, foundations that are already weakened by rate increases, staffing shortages, and systemic ableism. The disability community has long been one that, based on social contract, has done without, gotten by, made do. Please help make sure that in redesigning a system that is meant to help us, we are actually not beginning the first steps of reinstitutionalization. Let us stay here in the community where we belong. I want to note that you have 33 pages of letters, and unfortunately, there's a small number of us here in the room today. That's because it's really, really hard to get your staff to your home in time to make an 8:15 a.m. hearing. If we get a 10% cut, it's going to be even harder for us to get that staff into our homes. Anything more than that, we're probably not going to be in our homes. We're going to be in group homes, nursing homes, assisted livings. You are going to be paying a lot more money for us to have a lot less freedom. So please support this bill. Help us rebuild the trust with DHS. Help us rebuild the connection to make sure that we're going to be okay and we can stop being afraid of what's going to come next with Waiver Reimagine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have a few individuals through Zoom. The first person is Lisa Vala. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, chairs and members of the Human Services Committee. My name is Lisa Vala. I am a parent advocate. I've been following Waiver Reimagine for the past 3 years, and I'm more concerned than ever about the damage this poorly designed initiative will cause recipients living in their own homes. Waiver Reimagine will establish individual budgets that incentivize institutional care. The budget cuts to those living in their own homes are drastic without merit. Budgets should be based on need, not living setting. Doing otherwise violates the Olmstead Promise and the ADA integration mandate. So now I'm going to talk about my specific case. My daughter, Amanda, receives waivered services under a traditional DD waiver, and she lives in her own home. For those of you who are, the numbers are important, here are the numbers. Her current budget is $100,000 per year. Her estimated budget under Waiver Reimagine will be cut to $50,000 per year. That's a half. Her residential supports alone cost over $50,000. She will be forced to move out of her apartment, which she dearly loves, and into a group home that will cost more than $200,000 per year. But if you pass this common sense bill, House File 3800, her budget cut would be capped at 10%. Her budget would then be $90,000. She could afford her residential services and stay in her apartment. She would have to cut her day program and possibly home-delivered meals. Please pass this legislation to ensure that waiver recipients who live in their own homes have the budget to maintain their living setting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Addison Carpenter. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Addison Carpenter. I am 29 years old, and I live in Red Wing with my daughter, Lydia, and my partner, Adam. I am here not only as a person who utilizes waiver services, as a parent to a daughter who depends on those same services to remain in our family instead of an institution, but also as someone who has made it my mission in life to advocate for all Minnesotans living with disabilities. I'm asking you to support House File 3800 and the 10% funding limit it places on waiver reductions when the Waiver Reimagined is rolled out. This is not an abstract policy question for our family. It is the difference between Lydia growing up with her parents, who chose her when she was 14 years old, and being placed back in a residential facility. It is the difference between me living at home and getting the opportunity to be a change maker versus me being in the hospital. I live with a number of rare and serious medical conditions, including GOLD syndrome, primary adrenal insufficiency, gastroparesis, dysautonomia, and reoccurring infections that have resulted in 14 hospitalizations and 32 emergency room visits just this year alone. I also live with ADHD and dissociative identity disorder. While I fought to ever see the day that I turned 18 due to my mental health after losing my sister to suicide, I never thought I would have to fight to see the opportunity to watch Lydia grow up. My conditions are not stable, and they require consistent, coordinated support to keep me out of the hospital and in my home. My daughter Lydia has MEF2C haploinsufficiency, GOLD syndrome linked to a COL4A2 mutation, profound autism with a severe intellectual disability, seizures, and significant trauma from her early years of foster care. She spent 3.5 years in residential placement before we adopted her. When Lydia came to us, she came with a history of being removed from a home in part because she eloped, she ran, and no one could keep her safe. We are not a family that uses waiver services because it is convenient. We are a family that could not exist without them. Between Lydia and I, we utilize a number of different services and have required different ones in different amounts at various times in our life. For Lydia, we rely on CFSS to allow for her dad to stay home with her while I'm in the hospital. Respite through Crescent Cove to ensure respite for both her dad and I. Assistive tech that helps her regulate her sensory needs in a safe and healthy way. As well as a number of other supports. One of the biggest being a monitoring program that ensures Lydia cannot elope from our home, the very issue that led to her removal from her first family. For me, we are in the process of setting up nursing services in hopes that I can finally get to live the life that I have worked so hard for and that Lydia deserves, one where mom is home and mom gets to be the one to tuck her in at bed, or tuck her into bed at night, one where I get to be running our Minnesota Council on Disability meetings from the office instead of from a hospital room. Together, these services are what allowed us to adopt Lydia. They are what allow both of us to be a part of our community. They are what make our home safe, functional, and stable. When my nursing supports are fully in place, we expect my hospitalizations to decrease significantly. When Lydia has her assistive technology and monitoring system, she is safe. When we both can access adequate CFSS hours, her dad can be here, her and I's caregiver when I can't manage it on my own. If waiver funding is cut beyond 10% under Waiver Reimagined, the first things we would likely lose are Lydia's assistive technology, her respite care, and our family education services. For me, it would mean cuts to nursing hours, respite, and CFSS. And what does that mean in practice? More hospitalizations for me, fewer safeguards keeping Lydia in our home, the very real possibility that a child who has already survived 3.5 years in residential care, who finally has a family, a home, a safe place where the entire world revolves around her and we all just live in it, could be placed out of our home again because we no longer have the supports required to safely care for her. Cuts to our services do not save money in any real sense. They shift costs to hospitals, to emergency responders, to the residential facilities that would once again house my daughter. They shift it onto the backs of families who are already stretched far beyond what most people can imagine. People with complex medical needs and disabilities cannot adapt overnight to sweeping funding cuts. We are not in a position to simply figure it out. When our services are reduced, the consequences are immediate, serious, and sometimes irreversible. The 10% cap gives families like mine a fighting chance to remain stable during a transition period rather than falling off a cliff. I adopted Lydia because I believed she deserved a family. I believed that with the right supports, we could give her a safe and loving home. The services we receive are not a luxury. They are the architecture of our family. I urge you to support House File 3800. Protect families like ours. Keep people like Lydia home. Respectfully, Addison.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Michelle Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and representatives. My name is Michelle Anderson. My family are constituents of District 64B. I'm speaking today in support of House File 3800. I'm asking the committee to support this bill. My son Samuel is 14 and he has had a CDCS budget through the DD waiver since 2020. Each year there has been more red tape than hoops that we have had to jump through to continue to get him the support and services he needs through his CDCS budget. The first year that he was assessed under the new MinChoice 2.0, his budget was significantly cut. The MinChoice's model is not reliable, and it is on a trajectory that will force individuals with disabilities into institutions in defiance of the HCBS and the Olmstead ruling. In the disability community right now, there is a sense that the most vulnerable will be denied the care and accommodations they need in an unfocused effort to prove that the state of Minnesota is not tolerating fraud. I don't want to see fraud hurting our state either. It feels like an additional stigma and burden that has been added to those who have a family member with a disability. It's upsetting to see individuals and families who have been doing their best to follow all of the rules treated with suspicion and disregard because of things that happen with providers that serve or purport to serve people with disabilities. It's horrible to hear stories of people who won't get the in-home medical care that they need to survive, or who have become homeless because of their services being held up or cut back. The HSRI model, which has already been implemented in other states, has been litigated at the federal level under Olmstead, ADA, 1915C waiver sufficiency requirements, and the HCBS compliance standards. As a taxpayer in Minnesota, as well as a mother with a child who has a CDCS budget, I strongly question why we are moving forward with a model that is already being litigated and shown to be insufficient. Implementation of Waiver Reimagined will cause significant cuts to supports and services of disabled Minnesotans. HF 3800 is the last resort mitigation policy. It is not ideal, but it acts as a hold for harmless protection. I understand that the state of Minnesota will be going into the red in future years to come. This bill gives families like mine the opportunity to adjust to the budget cuts without it causing catastrophic harm. We ask that the cuts not be more than 10% to allow responsible parties like myself to adjust, to determine what expenses we are going to remove or what additional paid work I will try to seek and fit in order to keep my son's opportunities for community integration the same. I don't want to see any cuts, but I feel this is a good start to compromise for the road ahead with Waiver Reimagine. I want to also see individuals and families at the table when the Waiver Reimagined Task Force meets. I know that many in the disability community feel that Waiver Reimagined was rushed through without our support and without accounting for the input that has been given by the disability community. I feel that Minnesota DHS has chosen to operate independently from the legislature and has ignored the bills and laws written by our elected officials. I thank Representative Hicks for authoring this bill and being a strong voice for families in the Minnesota disability community. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify in support of HF 3800.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Jean Bender. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, members of the committee. My name is Jean Bender. I'm David's mom. He's an adult with multiple disabilities who can't be here today because he had kidney surgery on Monday. And to Jillian's earlier point, he won't get out of bed until I leave here and get back home to help him. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in favor of House File 3800. David is one of three adult children, but he's always needed significantly more support and family resources than his siblings. We've thoughtfully planned to ensure that David has the supports he needs so his siblings can accept a future guardianship role in their brother's life without totally disrupting their own lives and families. With current Waiver Reimagined budget plans, that won't happen. Because instead of receiving more supports when we can't provide most of his care, he will receive significantly less. According to any Waiver Reimagined budget information available, because David lives at home, he will receive less funding than if he lived in a residential provider setting, and all budgets will be capped at a certain dollar amount with no current exception process discussed. In David's early 20s, we bought a duplex so he could move to his own home while we lived upstairs and could be actively involved providing unpaid parent caregiving and ensure that he had the necessary services to transition to independent living with supports. Our son has a CAC waiver, which is a hospital nursing level of care, and he uses consumer-directed community supports with a budget that is, at maximum, one-third of the cost of the 24-hour care he would require in a residential setting. And that's if we could even find one with the nursing services that David needs. We believed that if we provided everything we could while we were healthy and able, we could rely on formal residential services in his duplex when we were not able to provide the majority of his care. But under the current proposal to assign funding based on where someone lives, what provider would serve him at home when they could get four times or more the funding in their facility? And what residential facility would take David and those with his level of need if reimbursement is capped? Those like David would lose placement options to people with fewer support needs. David's dad has terminal cancer. As we redid our wills and David's guardianship documents, David's sister, who is a nurse and well-equipped to take care of him, is so scared of the future lack of support that she made the heartbreaking request not to be his future guardian and to be removed from any future legal responsibility for her brother. David's brother lives out of state and won't be able to replace the supports that I provide. Waiver Reimagined budget information suggests that the Department of Human Services is banking on parents, siblings, and other family and friends' free labor, or they are instating a hierarchy that will allow people with low support needs to live in the community while those with high support needs are given no choice but congregate care. Adult siblings with their own families can't step into the role of full-time caregivers when parents like me are too old, too sick, or dead. And we all know that congregate care will cost a lot more money. Our family and others in our network and those who've written letters today have chosen person-centered living situations. We struggled with the system biased in favor of formal service providers and figured out how to cobble together the supports needed through personal sacrifice, individual research, and a focus on the strengths and human dignity of our disabled adults. We're scared that our family members will lose the homes we helped create for them when we can no longer fight for them. The only attempt to mitigate harm to my son and his peers is House File 3800, which states that budgets cannot be reduced by more than 10% without a decrease in support needs. Thank you to Representative Hicks and the disability advocacy organizations, the ARC, Autism Society of Minnesota, Disability Voice Advocates, Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, who wrote and support this legislation. And please consider transferring this bill language to any future legislation that results from DHS systems changes, such as the governor's proposal this week. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, members' discussion. Hearing none, Representative Hicks, you have, Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Chair Nora. I appreciate that. I wasn't here when Waiver Reimagine was developed, but it seems like a good faith effort to streamline the process, provide the services people need rather than what they would like to have, and bring some cost containment. Can you tell me, you know, why are we starting to try to modify it before we even finish rolling it out?
Representative Hicks.
Yes, I really appreciate that question because I wasn't here either. And in fact, I am supportive of Waiver Reimagine. My friends get kind of frustrated with me sometimes because I am supportive of where we're going. I think Minnesota's current waiver plan with all of the different disability-based criterias has been sort of a mess and has really been pretty unequal. And so I'm very supportive of Waiver Reimagine. This does not stop phase two. It just makes sure that as we go into phase two, if your needs haven't changed, your budget won't go down by more than 10%. That's all it does. And we're just laying it over because I do think that we probably need some additional changes and some language pieces because we do have to move forward with Waiver Reimagine, but I don't want to do that at the expense. I don't want people to go into it thinking that everything's going to be okay and for us to have messed it up and have, like, Gene's son, who is on a CAC waiver and has that level of need, suddenly, who has 24-hour needs, suddenly only be able to get care for 16 when, as Gene shared, her husband is dying and she's aging and his siblings aren't willing to do it. Because I don't know what we do with David if his father passes away and Gene has to be at the hospital in hospice with him and his siblings can't do it. Where's David going? Right? I don't want the change to institutionalize people. And so the goal here is to protect that by only allowing budgets to go down by no more than 10% unless there's been a change in need. Does that make sense? Does that answer the question?
Chair Norton, Representative Hicks, yes, that does answer my question. I appreciate your work on this, and I think you're right. I mean, we do need to certainly be careful because there are situations that are tough, right? I mean, this is a difficult deal, and I appreciate your work on this.
Your final closing remarks.
I want to thank the committee and all of my testifiers for coming today. We need to continue to work to make sure as we move forward that we are doing the best we can to protect people within the system that we have created. This legislature has worked really hard to do that, but the truth of the matter is that we are staring into a financial situation that, based on the cuts that were made last session, is being made on the backs of people with disabilities. And so I'd like to minimize the harm as much as possible.
Representative Hicks renews the motion, House File 3800, to be laid over. The House File 3800 is laid over. With that, we can exchange the seats.
Oh, I guess. I'm sorry. Do you want to sit? The last bill on the agenda is Chair Knorr's bill on continuity of care. This is an informational hearing as no official action will be taken. Chair Knorr, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. I'm sure you've been hearing stories about individuals who've been impacted as a result of many payment withholds, sanctions. Also, when entities that are providing care shuts down. I'm sure you've heard about the story of an individual who had autism that was in a setting that was providing ICS, that when you look into the system, the master leaseholder was the provider. The provider was evicted from the building. The individual ended up being evicted through that process. It took some time for that individual to be displaced in a care setting that should have protected that recipient. And we know that that recipient was on the streets, as we are informed. But that's only one person's story that we know. There are many others who have been impacted as a result of provider inability to continue to provide services for various reasons and not legally obligated to provide or operate that services. This is not the end. I received a letter from Pine County last night that shows that an assisted living setting with many individuals is set to close because that lead agency reported to the state to look into and investigate what was happening in an assisted living in Pine County. As a result of multiple inquiries, they're now being informed that many individuals who are living in assisted living and also other living assisted living setting in various places controlled by the same provider are going to be displaced. Setting up an assisted living with multiple individuals, more than 10, is not easy, members. Requires a lot of work, requires a lot of investment. The question is about informed choice. The question is about protecting those recipients. We're also aware of an individual who lost their life. We also know that there are many individuals who've been institutionalized. The question that we're trying to answer with this proposal is, who's responsible for what? How do we hold people accountable when a recipient is left on the streets, when a recipient is left in a hospital, when a recipient is institutionalized, that we take the choice away from that recipient? Madam Chair and members, this bill simply tries to rectify the problem. When the agency is no longer capable of providing the services, we can fight fraud, but ultimately, who are the victims of that fraud? The taxpayers, but also the person who's getting that service. And we need to be looking into the system, who's going to care for them? Where will they go next? And if you look through the bill, when services are abruptly stopped, when recipients lose their care support, when counties receive little notice for their action, when families are forced and individuals are forced into crisis situation, in many cases, the people affected are seniors, people with disabilities, individuals receiving home and community-based services. For them, service interruption can lead to hospitalization or institutional placement. This proposal prevents that. This proposal establishes recipient protection framework for situations where a provider experiences a serious operational event. These events include payment suspension, termination, license revocation, investigation for credible allegation, or even when they declare bankruptcy, inability to safely operate. When one of these events occur, we must prioritize the continuity of care. And I repeat that. That continuity of care is necessary for that individual to survive and to thrive. The complex care transition protection in this proposal applies when disruption of services that could lead to hospitalization, institutionalization, serious health concerns, even to the loss of housing that provided services to housing support and other elements. When that risk exists, the Department of Human Services and lead agencies must coordinate together to ensure that there's a safe transition of that recipient. The recipient must be informed and supported in selecting a new provider. Second, lead agency coordination. Counties or managed care organizations must work with recipients to ensure services continue. Third, informed choice protections. The recipient maintains their right to choose among available providers. For temporary transition support in complex care, there's a limited process that we can allow to stabilize the situation where a provider can continue to provide services, one, based on good cause that is required under the federal rules, two, to ensure that there are guardrails, to ensure that the funding or the funds that we're paying for doesn't go directly to the provider, but more of a transition. When we have a situation like this in nursing homes, we have a receivership process. When people are in assisted living setting or any other setting that has got residential services, there is no place to go. This issue has got real-world impact. Without destabilizing vulnerable people, this bill ensures that enforcing actions can proceed, program integrity is maintained, recipients remain protected. In closing, at the end of the day, this bill, this proposal reflects a simple principle. Program integrity should protect the taxpayers' fund and the people receiving care. This proposal helps Minnesotans do both. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and there are many individuals who signed up to testify today. So thank you, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Our first testifier is Josh Burke. Mr. Burke, can you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Josh Burke, and today I am simply here as an advocate. I will try to be brief because the voices you most need to hear today are the people who will speak after me. They are our neighbors. They are our Minnesotans. They are Minnesotans who did nothing wrong, who woke up one day to find the supports they rely on, supports that help them get out of bed, take their medications, get to work, and stay safely housed, suddenly in jeopardy. Not because of anything they did, but because the system moved without a safety net. I'm here to ask what we do is one simple humane thing. Put continuity of care in the center of everything we do moving forward this session and beyond. For months, I've had the honor to work alongside stakeholders, including provider associations, legislators, and advocacy organizations like the ARC Minnesota, the Disability Law Center and Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, the Minnesota Council on Disability, Elder Voice Family Advocates, MNCCD, and others. Together, we've asked, when enforcement actions happen, who catches people before they fall? Right now, too often, the answer is no one. Let's remember the standard we owe people. A colleague of yours in the other body put it well the other day. We root out fraud without disrupting services to the individuals who rely on them. That is the line we cannot cross. Chair Noor's continuity of bill draws that line in statute and backs it up with process. It defines the crisis moments, triggering events like sanctions, license loss, insolvency, or a provider's inability to safely operate, so no one wonders, does this apply to me? When these events hit, the clock starts on protections, not panic. It requires immediate, clear communication from providers, from the department, and from lead agencies, so people know what is happening, what their choices are, and how to keep services in place while they transition. It creates the complex transition tool for the most at-risk situations, exactly the cases where an abrupt stop would mean hospitalization, institutionalization, serious clinical deterioration, or a loss of housing or placement. In those cases, the bill requires a written operations plan. Identify high-risk individuals, stabilize them first, ensure medical records and medications follow, confirm receiving provider capacity, arrange transportation and handoffs, and communicate in the family's language. It authorizes a limited continuity period, up to 180 days, for the highest risk recipients so the systems have the runway to transition people safely. That continuity window does not erase sanctions or block enforcement. It prevents innocent people from being collateral damage while enforcement proceeds. That is compassionate, that is practical, and that is exactly what federal Medicaid rules expect of us when programs or networks change. Federal regulations requires continued services in a transition of care process when plan contracts or networks change. States must arrange for services without delay, allow temporary continuity with existing providers when clinically appropriate, and ensure timely referrals so people can't or aren't stranded. Federal regulation also requires care coordination and continuity as a core managed care standard. Every enrollee must have an ongoing source of care with coordination across settings, fee-for-service, other plans, and community supports. And when the state suspends payments based on credible allegations of fraud, CMS directs states to consider good cause not to suspend, or to suspend only in part when access to care would be disrupted. That is the federal balance. Act on fraud and protect beneficiary access. Program integrity and continuity of care are not competing values. They are simultaneous federal requirements. The NOR bill does not weaken enforcement. It operationalizes the federal standard that says do the right thing on fraud and do the right thing for individuals at the same time. Individuals such as the ventilator-dependent adult whose nurse knows the exact tilt of the bed in the alarm pattern that means move now. The person with a brain injury or mental health condition whose DSP is the reason the stove is off, the meds are taken, and the landlord isn't serving an eviction notice. The parent praying their child's autism therapy doesn't disappear this week because paperwork moved faster than a transition plan. For them, continuity isn't a convenience. It's the difference between stability and crisis, and crisis is expensive, financially and morally. And let me be crystal clear. Despite the governor's remarks this week, this room, others in the other body, and so many of us were not admiring the problem. This room is building workable, on-the-ground fixes that keep people safe, stable, and supported today. Madam Chair and members, please center the people who will testify after me as you move Chair Knorr's bill forward. Let's make sure that when enforcement actions are necessary, Minnesotans experience a handoff, not a hard stop. That is what decency requires. That is what federal Medicaid requires, and that is what this bill finally delivers. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is James Wilson.
Good. Mr. Wilson, could you identify yourself for the record?
Hi, I'm James Wilson. I live at Hillside. I'm receiving care there for the last 3 years. I'm in their facility for ICS housing. This morning I woke up and I had something prepared just already typed, but as I woke up and got my face washed, God spoke and just spoke to me and said, you need to speak from the heart. So here's where I'm at. My mother died 3 years ago. Can you give me a minute? My mom died 3 years ago, and the biggest thing that she would not want to see is this, what we're all going through. The possibility of getting eviction. We didn't do anything to do this. We didn't cause no harm. DHS. I don't know who's involved with DHS right now. It makes me sick because there is fraud out there. I'm not saying there isn't. But, man, target the people that are already doing fraud and let the doors keep open to the ones that are really legitimately good. Arnold, he's our president. He's the mad dog of this whole entire company. I can't tell you since there's been no funding for this since November for him. He hasn't gotten a dime. So it's come all out of the pocket. Everything he has just to keep the lights burning for however many properties he has. It's been all out of pocket. And now he's down to his last resorts. You are his last resorts. Every one of you circling this whole entire table are his last resorts. We are legit. MetroCare is legit. But one thing MetroCare Human Services is no more of is the life that we had in the hallways. The life that when you come in the office where that's your like safe spot and you could just come there to be with the staff that work there valiantly every day because they want to be there, not because they're there to get a paycheck, but because they want to. And you could just sit and chill with them and they'll have a TV on for you if that's what you wish. You go in there now and you just feel emptiness. Because there is a possibility of doors closing. You're going to hear from another guy coming up here in just a few minutes. And he's going to tell you he don't want to go back to a group home. I've been there. I've done group homes. My mom and my dad have fought valiantly so hard when I was in group homes. But I was the one who fought to get me out of a group home. I'm a fighter, and I believe in nothing but to fight when my back is against the walls, when I fight even harder. So I'm here today, guys, to tell you, don't shut us down. We're not the ones to be shut down. Yes, there's people out there that try to pocket money where they shouldn't be pocketing money. I don't know if that's the whole case involved. There's people else that have testified today that are struggling. People that have testify today because there's funding being cut by 10% to keep certain services going for them. Believe it or not, hello, we're affected by that.
Mr. Wilson, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story.
You.
I'm really glad that you have a good situation where you enjoy your provider and you're getting your supports. Thank you for sharing your story today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Next up, we have Matthew Gustafson. Mr. Gustafson, could you introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
What's that?
Can you introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
Matthew Gustafson. Sorry, I'm very stressed out from this whole ordeal. Didn't sleep last night, so I prepared something to read. The lack of ICS services because of the payments pause has had a significant impact on my well-being and mental health. The support that these services provide around the clock is extremely important in maintaining stability and safety in daily life. Without access to these, it has been very difficult to manage challenges that come up day to day. We miss the activities and structure and services. They still provide some services, but they're just doing it on their own dime. And since the payments were paused, they've been paused for 100 days. And seems a little ridiculous to me, but they're doing the best given the situation they are in. But it was nice knowing that when we were getting payments, that trained staff were available at any time. And it helped reduce anxiety and allowed us to focus on maintaining our health and independence. The financial impact of this situation is also is very stressful. We need the payments to be resumed. Because of the uncertainty around housing is overwhelming. Moving would be extremely difficult. Finding another apartment or group home or shelter or worse would mean paying a higher rent or putting a strain on our finances. And we're basically all on disability. You don't get very much on disability. So this situation has caused a great deal of personal exhaustion and stress. Trying to manage everything without the support previously in place has been physically and emotionally draining. Metro Human Services has been a great company to get services from. When I moved in, they were very responsive and supportive, installing grab bars in the shower and in curtains in my apartment. The level of responsiveness made a big difference in helping me settle in, and they made me feel at home. And I was proud to have my own apartment. So I don't think anyone wants to make anyone homeless or go without the services they desperately need. Please don't take away this place where I live. And the services I need to function. Finding somewhere else to go is not realistic. It can take months to years to get a placement. I feel extremely scared about. About what comes next. The uncertainty around the services and housing creates a fear of homelessness. The payments are not resumed. Losing the structure and support that helped keep us stable has made daily life much harder. Without these supports, there is a serious concern about our safety, health, and the possibility that things could become life-threatening if the situation deteriorates.
Thank you so much. You did a great job. It's important that we hear from you. Next up, we have Peter Wilcott.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
My name is Peter Wilcott, and I live at MetroCare Human Services, Falcon Heights, Larpenter Avenue location.
Thank you so much. Begin your testimony.
Yes. So I think we all know, sitting here with the DHS situation, there's a lot at stake, the process has been a little difficult as a resident because we simply don't know things. Certainly not what the future is going to bring with the ongoing investigation. And it certainly is rather apparent sitting here this morning that it's not the only portion of things undergoing changes. I just thought I would speak of the value of the services I am receiving, or at least before the investigation hit. There were several hours a day allocated to a resident before that, and now they can only literally devote 3 minutes, and that's mostly for a check-in call which we have had before. For those that are a little unfamiliar with how ICS functions, you live in an apartment like any other apartment, but there are services that come with it. I found this to be the most appropriate level of care for myself. I work with my father, who is my financial payee for my Social Security, and we were having trouble with me in regular apartments. That level of independence just is not for me. I was bottoming out. The isolation was difficult. I also require medication management. I am on probably in excess of 20 some pharmaceuticals, and the number of pills is daunting for me to organize. So once a week, MetroCare Human Services sets up my medication so I can remain med adherent. Be up here all morning. The ongoing personal relationships with the staff are enriching, and we even get to do great things to broaden our worlds. Like currently, I'm installing a raised bed vegetable garden, and I'm going in on my second semester of Norwegian language classes, which is part of what ICS helps us develop our lives. And soon I'll be job hunting as well with TASS Unlimited.
Thank you so much for sharing your story today. Next up, we have Brandon Bell. Mr. Bell, if you want to make your way to the table and introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
You're welcome. Right here?
Right here. No, this side. You can come here. Yep.
Big table.
Yeah.
Big chair.
Okay.
You even get a microphone, Mr. Bell.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Yep, you got it.
Huh? How y'all doing?
Doing good.
Everybody's good?
Yep.
I want to start off by saying praise to the most to the Most High that we all here together in solidarity. And I want to say that I live in my name is Brandon Bell, okay? And I live in the ICS setting at Sylvan for Karen LLC. And where can I start? You know what I'm saying? It's like ever since this alleged fraud stuff been going on, I get it, you know what I'm saying? And I understand that there's people out here that's doing that, but just like everybody else here says, you know what I'm saying, target those that are doing the fraud, you know what I'm saying, and keep the people that needs these services open, you know what I'm saying, funded, because I'm a single father of a 5-year-old son, all right? I came a long way from doing time in prison. To tell you the truth, you know what I'm saying? I had killed someone that had molested my oldest daughter when she was 4 years old. And that was back in 94, 95. You know, I do regret that I did what I did, but you know, which father or parent, some people don't understand when you have a child, man, you're supposed to protect that child, you know what I'm saying? Your child, and you don't want your child to be hurt by anyone who's a child molester or a rapist. And, you know, I was a former gang member, you know what I'm saying? I was selling drugs. I stopped selling drugs. I was boxing at the time. I had 4 other kids. But when my daughter was raped, I just took care of my business, you know? But I did my time. I just got a paper on August 3rd that just passed, and
I got full custody of my 5-year-old son in September. They gave me custody of my son, so and everything was good until all this fraud stuff happened, and they started to stop funding the programs. And like I said, like everybody said, you know what I'm saying, it's hard for the ones that need the program. It's hard because I was getting all my services, you know, all my activities. You know what I'm saying? Me and my son was going out, you know what I'm saying? I'll take care of my baby, you know, my son, and everything was good. And now it's like, what's next? What's about to happen next? You know what I'm saying? Like, are we going to get kicked out of our apartments? And, you know what I'm saying? And it's just that I have disabilities myself. I have health problems myself. I'm temporarily blind in my right eye, you know what I'm saying? I'm a type 2 diabetic, so and I have severe arthritis from years of boxing. So you know, see, I still and it's hard to maintain that and then taking care of my son. Can you stop my phone, please? I'm sorry, but I'm sorry for the interrupting, but please, can y'all please hear our voice and keep the money flowing, man, and help us, please, because, man, come on, man, help me, man, talk.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bell. We have one more testifier today.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Come on, testify, brother. All
right. We have one more testifier today, Sarah Sweeney.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. Can you identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
My name is Sarah Sweeney. I receive ICS services on Bush Avenue. For Caring LLC. Okay. So as a vulnerable adult living in Minnesota, losing my integrated community services, ICS, has had a significant negative impact on my daily life and stability. The services my ICS provider delivered were essential in helping me manage my disability and maintain independence in the community. My ICS provider supported me with several critical daily needs. Staff assisted me with organizing and attending important medical and health appointments, ensuring that I was able to manage my health properly. They also helped me stay on track with important responsibilities such as managing paperwork, maintaining my living environment, and keeping up with essential tasks that can be overwhelming because of my disability. In addition, ICS staff help guide and support me with life stability skills, including maintaining routines, cooking, addressing challenges that arise from my disability, and connecting me with the necessary resources. Their support helped me function safely and avoid situations that could put my health or housing stability at risk. Since losing these services, I no longer have the structured support that helped me navigate daily responsibilities. I currently do not have a job, which makes it extremely difficult to keep up my basic expenses, such as paying my utility bills and maintaining a stable household. Without staff assistance, it is also much harder for me to consistently attend important health appointments and manage critical aspects of my daily life. The loss of ICS services has created significant hardship and instability. These supports were not optional. They were necessary for me to maintain my health, stability, and ability to live safely in the community. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Do any other members of the public wish to testify? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All I'm going to say is thanks for bringing this forward. We're trying to root out fraud, and we're doing the payment pause, and we're doing all these other things. And we had the unintended consequence of cessation of service for some folks who really need it. And I appreciate that you're raising our awareness of that and actually putting together a game plan for how we have that continuity of care for these dear souls. So thank you.
Anyone else? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Knorr. And thank you so much to the folks who were able to come and share your stories today. It's my hope that after this committee, that folks that aren't sitting at this table this morning, who are charged with passing legislation to get this right, take the time to review the testimony from all of you today. And I, you know, take it upon myself, and I hope my colleagues will too, to spread the word to our other colleagues about your experiences. I don't want this room to be the only room where you're heard, and for that to go away. What you've said today is so incredibly important, and we absolutely cannot ignore it. And I am so grateful, so, so grateful that you were able to get here today to share your story. And I'm sorry that you're in the position that you had to do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Curran. Representative Knorr, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill is just in the draft form. That's why we brought it up, so that we can all work together and come up with a plan. We know that there are consequences for actions of people who are committing fraud, but also the people who are recipients, that it's our responsibility to care for them. It's our responsibility to find a suitable place that they can be placed. It's upon DHS, the lead agency, this body, to make the right decision. Just wanted to thank everyone who came here to testify on this issue. You have heard from a few. There are hundreds of people who are now being impacted. Hundreds of people who have been impacted. An additional more will be impacted. If we don't stay ahead of this challenge, we may end up facing significant challenges down the road. We now have an opportunity to come up with a plan that addresses the needs of those who are victims, because I consider them to be the victims of the fraud that we're trying to address, but also the victims of losing their care that they need. Members, this is about life and death situation. And if we don't do the right thing, we will keep on finger pointing somebody else's problem. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you to all those who testified today. We will get together and come up with a plan this session, not next time, this session, to come up with a plan that solves some of the challenges that we're being faced with. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you so much, Chair Knorr. With no more business before us, we get to come back Tuesday at 8:15.
Thank you. I feel excited.
Committee is adjourned. Ooh.